You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me once again Lynn Alden. And I should mention the website to go to for Lynn Alden's work and to subscribe to her service is simply lynnalden.com, lynnalden.com. She has been really quite a rising star, I would say. I see her more and more in various interviews on the internet and various places. And there's a reason for that, because she's been very very astute and very accurate about the way she views things. And I think applying her engineering skills sort of gets under the hood and understands sort of diagnoses and sort of explains what is going on and why things are happening the way they are. It's always good to have that understanding as well. Thanks for joining me again, Lynn. So good to have you.
Hey, thanks for having me back. Glad to be here.
It's really good to have you. We've titled today's show, Is America Facing Stagflation Like That of the 70s? Sort of what I feel as one who lived through that period of time. But when I read your article this morning titled Fiscal Driven Inflation from your May newsletter, I think I really had to accept your argument that what we're going through now looks more like the 1940s for various reasons. And I want to get into that maybe right away. But maybe you can talk about the characteristics of the long debt cycle first, though, because that's sort of the structure that you're looking at. We have these long periods of, 70 or 80 years, perhaps, these long cycles. And as we go through the cycle, it changes. Well, I'll let you tell the story. The long debt cycle, and you talked about Ray Dalio first sort of popularized this idea, but talk to us about it.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, that was a concept popularized by Ray Dalio, Bridgewater fame over the past decade, and it's something that I've incorporated into my analysis that I've kind of done a lot of independent analysis on. And basically what the idea there is that, you have the normal credit cycle, the 5 to 10 year credit cycle. But normally what happens is that, when you have a deleveraging event, you don't end up deleveraging all the way back down to the starting point as a percentage of GDP. Mm-hmm. And so, basically policymakers come in, they do stimulus, they cut interest rates. And so what you have over the course of multiple decades is you have multiple credit cycles, and each time you end up with higher and higher debt as a percentage of GDP, and you end up with lower and lower interest rates as a percentage of GDP. And that starts to come to a head when you get down to zero interest rates and very, very high debt levels. And so if you look at multiple long-term charts like I presented in that article, in many ways, the current environment looks a lot like the 1940s, and the past decade looks a lot like the 1930s in terms of where we stand in terms of the private debt bubble and the public debt bubble. And so in that sort of cycle that we're facing now, basically the release valve ends up being the currency. And so what they do is they generally do more fiscal stimulus. They have higher inflation levels while still holding rates at, near zero levels. And so if you're holding cash or bonds, you end up, losing over the course of that decade in terms of purchasing power. And so for multiple reasons, I'm finding a lot of parallels between the 1930s and 40s compared to the 2010s and the 2020s.
Mm-hmm. And as the cycle matures, as you say, the rates keep getting lower, but the debt to GDP keeps rising. The central bankers seem to be in control to a great extent, but they can't allow interest rates to rise too much. Is that the reason rates keep getting lower? Because the debt burden is so great, the system can't take it, and so they have to keep shoveling more money into the system to try to keep the rates from rising? Is that what's going on?
That's one of the big factors, yes. And it's also we're seeing a transformation of private sector debt into public sector debt. And so a really good example of that was Japan. Over the past 20 years or so, you saw a significant amount of private sector debt get deleveraged while the public sector leveraged up. And so we're seeing that more and more in the United States and Europe as well, where private sector debt is being kind of transformed through fiscal policy and through other policies into more and more, you know, debt that's directly on the federal balance sheet. And you saw that back in the 30s and 40s, and we're seeing it again play out now. And that is one of the key differences between the 40s and the 70s, in the sense that in the 40s, when they were dealing with, you know, they're fighting World War II, they're doing all this fiscal stimulus in a sense, and yet they could not, you know, no matter how high inflation got, they could not let yields rise because that would render, you know, the fiscal situation insolvent. Whereas the 70s, because you had low federal debt and low private debt as a percentage of GDP, Volcker was able to raise interest rates in order to combat inflation. And so basically most metrics look more like the 40s than the 70s in many ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so as we get towards the end, then it's just not possible to, because I remember vividly, I mean, I'm probably twice your age, Lynn, and I our first mortgage was a 17.5% mortgage when Mr. Volcker was able to raise interest rates. I don't know what the Fed funds rate were, but they were lower than that, but they were double digits. We had double digit inflation. I can't imagine. I mean, where do you think the breaking point is now? It seems like the equity market may be struggling a little bit now, what do we have on the 10-year? 2.7 or something like that?
Yeah, absolutely. And growth stocks are more vulnerable than value stocks. And so, for example, bank stocks prefer those higher yields, whereas those really, really high multiple growth stocks, especially the younger kind of unprofitable growth stocks, they're very sensitive to higher interest rates, at least in terms of their valuation. And so, as the interest rate, if for example, a 10-year goes above 2.5%, 3%, that starts causing significant pain points for the broader stock market, especially centered on those more growth oriented names.
As this debt cycle matures, or as it get, you know, from its start and through the life of it, it seems as though we have this massive, especially towards the end, massive redistribution of wealth. I've seen that. I think from 2008 or so, the Fed the deposits have grown very dramatically, but the loans have not kept up with that, and so we're seeing money not getting into Main Street through the lending process. As you point out, I think in your article you said in 2008 we sort of saw the height in terms of public, that is private debt. So why does this happen? I mean, we have this redistribution of wealth that has become really very pronounced in recent years. Why does this happen? Why are banks no longer lending out to the private sector? Is it because the private sector is becoming insolvent or less prosperous or what? Why do you think that is?
Well, there's a few reasons for that. One, basically there's a mismatch between the people that demand loans versus the types of loans that the banks want to make. And so, for example, the types of people that the banks would prefer to loan to, people with, very high credit scores, and that are very, strong financially, they don't have a large demand for loans at the current time. They're doing pretty well. On the other hand, there are a lot of risky businesses that they would prefer to get loans, and the banks don't have a very large incentive to lend to them with interest rates this low. And so, because they take on credit risk and all sorts of things like that. And so basically there's partially a mismatch. And this, again, is, the last time we saw this magnitude of banks really not lending out a large portion of their deposits was back in the 40s. And so one of the key differences between the 70s and the 40s in terms of those are the past two inflationary decades of the past century. And we often think of the 70s as inflationary because that was the more recent one, but the 70s were a very loan driven type of inflation. And so bank lending was growing very rapidly. You also had a rising fiscal deficit that supported that, but a significant part of it was very loan-driven inflation. And then, of course, you had commodity shortages, especially oil shortages from abroad. And so the difference is that the 40s, it wasn't really driven by bank lending. It was driven by basically fiscal stimulus. And so basically what happened was the banks end up buying large portions of those treasuries. And so banks are indirectly lending, but it's through the federal channel. And so, for example, you had very fiscal-driven inflation, and what makes that different is that it can spike up very, very high, and that it can go away very quickly if the federal government, you know, stops running those deficits. And so in the 40s, you saw these, you know, it basically you had inflation go as high as 20% and then literally disappear the next year and kind of stop going up. And then you had, you know, another year later, you'd have it spike up to like, you know, 12% and then go back down to like 2%. And so that kind of weird off or on inflation is more driven by fiscal, you know, kind of the fiscal direction, whereas it's not, you know, the 70s was a smoother type of inflation because that was more bank loan driven and kind of more from the private sector side. And so basically what we're seeing now is that because things are very fiscally driven, there's not a lot of lending happening in the economy. And so banks are basically stuffed full of treasuries and reserves rather than making a lot of private sector loans.
Right. So, I mean, I think that your answer to my question is, in fact, the large majority of people, the mismatch that you talked about, the people that are not credit worthy but need the money. So we've had a drain from the middle class that's taken place during this cycle. Maybe you could argue the same thing happened in the 1920s, back in the days of the robber barons and so forth. But I wonder to what extent this redistribution of income from the middle class to the top 1% or 10% or 5%, whatever you want to break it down, to what extent that is playing out in this political populism that we're seeing, not only in the United States, but in other places in Western Europe and places like that.
No, I think those variables are very much connected. And so, you know, again, that there's similarities going back, you know, to the 20s, 30s, and 40s, where you had very high wealth concentration, and then, you know, you got rising populism out of that. And then that resulted in more redistributive type of policies. And so we're seeing a similar event now. We have, in many ways, very, very high wealth concentration. And over the course of the past decade, we're seeing more and more kind of pushback against that. And so I often conceptualize as a big pendulum that swings back and forth between, you know, labor politics having more power versus capital politics having more power. And so currently we've been very much on the side of capital. And because, you know, labor's been, you know, damaged by, for example, offshoring and automation, it very much reduced their kind of bargaining power. And so we're very, very far on the capital side. And the risk is that, you know, you can push things back towards the labor side. And that could be, you know, basically you change different segments of the population about how well they do. And so generally when you have more labor power, it's good for wages, but it also pushes down generally asset prices. And so when it comes to navigating a portfolio, it helps to kind of kind of focus on those trends. And one of the things we've seen, if there's a big difference between now and the 1940s, is that in many ways the United States looks more like the United Kingdom did in the 1940s, in the sense that back in the 40s, the United States was, you know, we were a major creditor nation.
Yes.
That we owned more foreign assets than foreigners owned of our assets.
Right.
And we were an exporter. And so basically, you know, at the time, we were kind of the China of the time. We were an emerging market that grew up into a powerhouse, and then we were selling things, say, for cheaper than the United Kingdom could, and we basically were rising power. And so now we look more like the UK in the sense that, you know, we're running trade deficits. We are a net debtor nation, meaning that foreigners own more U.S. assets than Americans own of foreign assets. And so basically, you know, most metrics look a lot like the 1940s, with the exception that we're also going through it with a trade deficit and as a debtor nation. And that certainly played a role in wealth concentration because, for example, you actually see somewhat lower wealth concentration in Japan or Europe than you do in the United States now. And that's in a large part because we've exported a large portion of our manufacturing base and other types of blue-collar jobs at a faster rate than most of those other developed countries have. And so we've really kind of, you know, made our economy quite top-heavy in terms of those that do well versus, you know, really kind of, you know, accelerating the shift away from blue-collar jobs. And that's you know, partially been responsible for hollowing out the middle class at a faster rate than you see in some of these other countries.
Yeah, for sure. But I have to wonder, Lynn, you know, with the transfer payments, the stimulus money going out, the thousands of dollars to millions of investors, I mean, to millions of American people with lower paid jobs, I have to wonder if the threat of sort of some wage inflation might not be brewing because, you know, you're hearing reports all around the country with the stimulus checks. People are saying, well, why should I go back to work when I actually make more by not working, or slightly more, or maybe not quite as much, but I don't have to work and I can use my time to do some other things. So there's a lot of restaurants and smaller businesses that are having a real tough time finding labor. And I have to wonder if that's not going to force wages up. You know, you can try to mandate minimum wages and so forth, but this might be another way of doing it, just to the extent Mr. Biden is able to do it, to keep sending trillions of dollars to individuals to sit on the couch. Well, to get them to come back to work, you're going to have to bid up the wages, right?
I think we are seeing that to some extent, and that can put upward pressure on wages and then by extension, upward pressure on prices. And an example that I used recently was that the Chipotle stores around my area, they started to do these days where they basically had online order only days because they had to run like a tighter ship because they didn't have enough labor. And then there were a couple days where they had to just close early because they were out of labor. Mm-hmm. So that translates into higher labor costs. So we saw, for example, Chipotle did a national campaign where they were going to start paying higher wages both to the kind of the basic workers as well as the store managers. So we are seeing, and that's pretty much got to trickle through to the food prices. Uh-huh. And so I do think, after a pretty long stretch of not really having a lot of wage growth, I think we are on the verge of more wage growth, in part because of these policies. But the key, there are still some dates to look out for. So, for example, some of those, the key unemployment benefits expire in September. Those are unlikely to be renewed because now, of course, we have a lot of, kind of pushback against those policies because of the impacts they're having on, places like the restaurant industry. And so when you look out past September into maybe the fourth quarter of this year, we have to see how sticky some of those, wage increases are. And so a lot of companies, for example, they've been reluctant to raise wages because they see kind of a light at the end of the tunnel for these unemployment benefits. And so instead they try to do things like bigger sign-on bonuses, basically larger one-time payments in order to encourage workers to sign up. And so we have to see basically as we go into quarter four of this year, how much of that kind of sticks through, after some of these benefits expire.
It certainly has to be a question. I wonder, with regard to the dollar now, there's some concerns. Some large hedge fund manager whose name escapes my memory right now was really voicing concern, I think, on CNBC last week sometime about...
That would be Stanley Druckenmiller.
Thank you. That's exactly who I was talking about. And he's really concerned about the dollar. It seems to me that if all the other countries are doing the same thing, but maybe we're being more aggressive than some of the other our trading partners in terms of printing money and doling out freebies, or maybe the Western countries were doing more of this in the past, and now it's something, I don't know. What are your thoughts? So do you see a threat for the dollar somewhere down the road as a result of what's going on now? And, you mentioned that we're now where the UK was in the 40s, kind of. So we're not in a position of strength as we were in the 40s or as China is now, it would seem.
Yes, I've been dollar bearish since October 2019, when the dollar index was about 99. And so it's been one of my key themes of kind of tracking this go down and kind of pay attention to, various counter rallies that happen. And so obviously in the March period of 2020, we had a curveball from the pandemic that briefly pushed up the dollar. The first couple months of this year, we had another kind of counter rally. And so I've been monitoring these counter rallies, but overall, I remain structurally dollar bearish. And there's a few reasons for that. One is that the U.S. runs structural trade deficits, whereas our biggest trading partners, China, Europe, Japan, they run more balanced trade situations. When we're running pretty tight monetary policy compared to the rest of the world, as we were, for example, during the period of quantitative tightening in 2018, 2019, that tends to be a more strong for the dollar. But as soon as we kind of join the rest of the world in having rather loose monetary policy, our currency tends to fall because the natural direction for it to go is down because of those trade deficits. The second reason is that in 2020, in part because we have more wealth concentration and more we basically export our supply chains at a faster rate. The United States did do larger fiscal stimulus as a percentage of GDP compared to most of those other countries.
Uh-huh.
And so, for example, if you look at broad money supply growth on a percentage basis year over year, the United States had something like 25% M2 growth last year, and Canada was also pretty similar. But most other European nations and Japan, theirs was more like 10 or 12% year over year. And so basically we created more money, and so it makes sense that our currency devalued by roughly that same amount. But that, of course, takes turns over time. And so, for example, during the past several months, we've seen Europe, for example, has been more aggressive with monetary policy in the sense that they're doing, faster QE and they're holding their interest rates at lower levels. But overall, if you look at, broad money supply creation as well as inflation-adjusted interest rates, by those metrics, the United States being more aggressive in terms of devaluing its currency.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think before we run out of time here, I want to ask you what, given what we're just talking about now and what you're seeing, more of a 40s scenario, how is that impacting the kind of investments that you're making, Lynn? And I know that you're very generous in sharing your thoughts and what you're doing at least with your paid subscribers. And I should tell people that, this article, Fiscal Driven Inflation, and all the other, so many of your newsletter is really free. It's available. At least that part of your work is free. How is it impacting what you're buying and what you're investing in?
So generally, in some ways, I maintain an all-weather portfolio, but I tilt it in different directions based on what asset class is likely to do well. And so for a while now, I've had more of an inflationary tilt in the sense that I'm more tilted towards value stocks and growth stocks. I'm more tilted towards commodity stocks, precious metals, things like that. We've used allocations to Bitcoin even basically with risk management in place. And basically by having exposure to some of these more, these asset classes that in many ways benefit from currency devaluation, that's kind of benefited the portfolio. And I do think that those types of things are likely to work well through the 2020s, but it won't be in a straight line. And so there will be periods of time where you have kind of a more disinflationary cycle within an otherwise inflationary trend. And actually, if you go back to the 1940s and the 1970s, inflation was not a straight line in either of those decades. You had periods of rapid inflation,
sure,
and then you had cooling off periods. And so you can have these significant counter rallies in those other types of assets. And so basically what I try to do is keep the big picture in mind in terms of the types of assets that are likely to do well in the 2020s, like value stocks, precious metals, commodities, things like that, while also kind of paying attention to this more rate of change things to see, when there are times where you might want a little bit more cash or growth stocks in the portfolio as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, and again, with more specific information and what you're buying and so forth, you do share that with your subscribers, don't you?
Yeah, basically, my free newsletter comes out every 6 weeks. We do reveal a lot of portfolio positions, but then the premium service comes out more regularly and has more portfolios that people can use, maybe to add that to their own their own investment style.
Sure, and I should mention that your premium is very reasonably priced. I would suggest that everyone listening to this show could certainly afford it. So it's not like you're getting stingy with your. You're very kind to make it available at a price that most people can afford. A minute left. I wondered if you could take 30 seconds to just comment real quickly on the repo market. Maybe that's unkind to ask you that, but we're seeing more action in the repo and I think the reverse repo market. Is it anything we should be keeping our eyes on?
I'm keeping my eye on it. I covered it in my last report, but essentially what we're seeing is the opposite of September 2019 when we had the repo rate spike. So that was a situation of too many T-bills and not enough reserves, whereas right now the issue is that there's actually too much reserves in the system, and so banks are basically spilling that over into reverse repos. And it's actually we had kind of a similar thing happen back in 2014, 2015.
Okay. All right. Well, people want to really understand this stuff, they should sign up for your letter and get on your website, which again is lynnalden.com, I believe. All right. Okay, well, thank you so much, Lynn, for being with us. Always great to have you, and thank you.
Thanks,
folks, that is it. You bet. Thanks. That's it for this week, folks. Next week, I'm going to have David Rosenberg with me, and Dr. Quentin Henning will update us on some of his, he's going to talk about the silver-rich polymetallic project in Bolivia that's really, I think, a very exciting story. So I hope that you'll join me next week. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.